This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We've talked a lot about the state of Vermont's plan to get 90% renewable energy sources by 2050. And it's actually written into the statute that we need to be about a quarter of the way there by 2025. Okay, all well and good, but how? And what ability do regular Vermonters have to influence the specifics of how we get there? A lot of that is done through the public input period after a draft of the state's comprehensive energy plan is released. That's exactly the time period we're in right now. A new energy plan will be released by January, so right now the Public Service Department is taking public comment and tweaking the draft that's already been put out. Today we are going to be joined by the Director of Energy Policy and Planning for the department, and he's taking your comments on the show. We're going to look at what the comprehensive energy plan is supposed to represent, how it acts as a guide for Vermont's energy policy moving forward, and we'll speak with representatives of communities and industry to see what some of the big constituencies have to say. But if you would like to weigh in, you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net or call 1-800-639-2211. That number again is 1-800-639-2211. Asa Hopkins is the Public Service Department's Director of Energy Policy and Planning. It's a pleasure to have you on the show today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So, the actual comprehensive energy plan is a rather unwieldy document. It's some 300, nearly 400 pages long. And we actually have a link to the full plan on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net for people who want to read through it or use it as a doorstop. But for people who are a little bit less aware of it than many of our commenters are, who've already been weighing in on this before the show even started, can you just share the overall idea of what the comprehensive energy plan is designed to do and be?
So the Comprehensive Energy Plan is required by statute, as you mentioned. We're supposed to look every 6 years at where we get our energy from, how do we use it, what do we use it for, what are the costs associated with it, both economic and environmental costs that are associated with it, and if there are particular recommendations of new policies or legislation or regulation that would be appropriate to guide the state going forward, advancing our state's energy policy.
And how is the draft plan that's out now different from the 2011 plan?
So the 2011 plan really gave us a great starting point. It was the first plan that had actually been completed and adopted in 13 years. 1998 was the previous one.
And going forward is the six-year rule now? You have to redo it every 6 years?
It's 4 years from that one to this one, and then every 6 years after that. So it's put on a more official schedule. So that plan gave us a starting point. A lot of really good ideas in there, some really ambitious goals, the 90% goal for 2050, most particularly. It being the first one in a while, there were some gaps still. There was some analysis that still needed to be done. And a lot of the recommendations in that plan were to do more studies and more analysis to know exactly what it would take to get there. And we've conducted a lot of those analyses in the intervening few years, and they inform, I think, a much more detailed and analytic-based plan this time around.
But is it still, this is what we were trying to get to, or is it, we already know what we're trying to get to, 90% renewables, and we have these interim targets, and here's how we're going to do it?
It's some of each. We have new interim targets. I mean, last time we just had basically the 2050 goal. And because of the analysis we've been able to do in the meantime, we now have that 25 by 25 goal really backed up by analysis. It was already in statute, but now we know exactly, a lot more sense of what it takes to actually do that in the next 10 years. We have goals for 2030. We have a total energy use reduction goal for both 2025 and 2030. So we have a much better sense at the top level of what it takes, but also we have a lot better sense of what technologies we're going to need to rely on or at least are intriguing and how much of what we would actually take to get there. We've made a reasonable deal amount of advancement in terms of various statutes that have passed the last few years. There are probably more to do in terms of figuring out what the next actual policies to put in place, where might funding come from, those kinds of particulars. And we try to lay out more of those in this version of the plan than last time.
Is this a plan that anybody has to follow?
So there is there's one official regulatory hook in utility regulatory proceedings. Things that come before the Public Service Board have to be consistent with this plan. So it does have that regulatory hook. which is why we have to go through this extensive public process to make sure that it actually reflects the will of the state.
I'll tick off a couple of the tangible goalposts that are in this plan. One is reduce total energy consumption per capita by 15% by 2025 and by more than one-third by 2050. You want to meet 25% of the remaining energy need from renewable sources by 2025. That's what we've talked about as being in statute already. 40% by 2035 and 90% by 2050. And then you have three end-use sector goals for 2025. You want 10% renewable transportation, 30% renewable buildings, and 67% renewable electric power. And we're going to talk about some of those sectors because the electrical power is, you know, pretty well away already. The transportation goals are going to be a little harder to reach. But let's talk about public input here as we get calls lined up. How was public input factored into actually coming up with the draft in the first place?
So we had four public forums around the state in July that were, I think, quite well attended. I gave a short intro at each of those, but really the bulk of the meat and the point of those was an hour-long sort of brainstorming, really hearing from folks, having folks weigh in terms of in writing and otherwise to really get our juices flowing and get a sense of the ideas that are out there and where people are at. We also held a series of four expert stakeholder meetings, one on transportation, one on electric power, et cetera, just to make sure that we really understood what the state of play was and chance to sort of test some ideas against those experts and see what was going to stick with respect to making it into the draft plan.
And what about now? I mean, you've already had a couple of public meetings on the draft, and there are three more that are scheduled. And again, we have links to all of those as well on our page at vpr.net. But I think to some people, it can sometimes feel like this is sort of a futile exercise in speaking your mind and having people nod like they're listening very carefully and then not doing anything. I mean, the draft is already out. So what is the point and the purpose and the outcome of public input now?
So you're right. We have had two public hearings. The first was in Lindenville 2 weeks ago and then in Essex last week. I think, it really is a draft. We put out ideas and we want to know whether they're the wrong ideas, whether there's other ideas that are better, whether someone points out that something that we suggested doesn't even meet our own criteria for what should be an idea that rises to the top. It's also just a chance to get a sense of what the hot button issues are. And frankly, folks who are really passionate about a particular issue and who show up and who have already turned to page 292 and know that this word is really wrong as far as they're concerned, that's really valuable to us too, because it enables us to really understand what the impacts are of the words that we write and how people are going to read them. Because we can write what we think we are saying, but we need to understand how people are hearing it as well.
So since you've already had two meetings, do you already know things that you're going to change in the final printing of the comprehensive energy plan?
So the two topics that have gotten the most attention so far at those public hearings are siting issues, predominantly in the Northeast Kingdom. It was more about wind, but solar has also come up, and we expect to hear more on that. That's obviously an area where we are already deeply involved in trying to figure out what the plan should say. There's a solar siting task force going on right now, so we already know that that's an issue that we're going to have to revisit and just be able to put that much more into the plan than was in the draft already. So hearing what we hear from folks can inform of what that is. And the other issue we've heard a lot about is people coming in to tell us about the importance of putting a price on carbon in some fashion, whether it's a cap and trade or a carbon tax or the like. And the plan addresses that to some extent already, although given the level of public interest in it, it's that much more important to us to make sure that we really frame that issue up well and draw attention to how it's addressed in the final plan.
As you might imagine, we got a comment on that before the show. And listeners, if you'd like to weigh in, we're talking about how Vermont comes up with its plan for renewable energy and what the process is for people who want to weigh in on what they think the plan should be, or maybe you've already read the draft plan and you have really concrete thoughts. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. There's already a really robust discussion going on there. I'll read you, Asa Hopkins, a couple of comments that have come in, and then a couple that we can also really chew on. Ben in North Hero says, I fully support the state's renewable energy goals. The need to move from a fossil fuel economy to a renewable one is urgent. In addition, a growing number of us in Vermont and around the world are finding meaningful employment in the renewable energy field. To support greener energy as well as keeping Vermonters employed in the state, I believe that some means of pricing carbon is necessary. This could come in the form of greater penalties than already planned for not meeting renewable energy production and energy consumption reduction goals, and or a pricing structure as a penalty for carbon production that's more of a motivator than what the legislature has passed so far. Someone writing under the handle New Clear Waste says, in an ideal world, generation would happen where there's high potential. The resulting power would be channeled to where demand is high, and that distance would be as short as possible. To a certain extent, that means generation in rural areas to feed urban areas. That doesn't mean that large towns should get to shirk their share of the responsibility for generation, however. And then Hans says, the current draft of the Vermont Energy Plan is not a plan, but merely a menu, like the menu of a Chinese restaurant, where you find a long list of dishes with weird names that are meaningless unless you already know beforehand what you want to order. At the very least, the Energy Plan needs to include a summary that lists the possible renewable systems in order of rank, according to how much carbon footprint is averted at what cost in dollars per ton of carbon. What do you think about that? I mean, how do you think, Asa Hopkins, about what the Comprehensive Energy Plan should be? And is it just sort of a menu of options? Is that maybe the goal?
So, I think something that's this big can look like a menu. There are a lot of things that are not in it, however, right? It's a big, complicated problem. There's a lot of different levers that need to be pulled, a lot of different areas where you need to make an impact. We do recognize that the plan is a reference document, and so that some bulk of it is providing background information so that the reader can understand what the recommendations are and why they're appropriate recommendations. One thing that's different about this version of the plan is that we put a lot of thought into figuring out how we should prioritize. We put a chapter up front that's really a sort of a statement of principles, and boiled down. It summarizes on a nice page the need to build a vibrant and equitable economy, advance healthy ecosystems and healthy human health, healthy Vermonters, and really we want to be able to test each of our recommendations against those things. Different technologies, different paths forward should test against those, and that should lead to some kind of prioritization. I don't know whether just a sort of dollar per ton of carbon, that gets at one of those things, but there's a jobs aspect, there's a human health aspect, there's an affordability and equity aspects. So you want to be able to weigh against all of those different factors.
We got a note from Rick who says, I'd like to see a Green Technology Development Council set up. Similar councils have been very effective in stimulating technology development in East Asian countries. The council would include public, private, and nonprofit entities working in technology development and dissemination. It would set priorities and coordinate activities. It would, for example, search for low-cost weatherization techniques used elsewhere and then bring and adapt them to Vermont. Many of the technologies developed could be exported out of the state, turning this energy transformation into an economic growth activity, as well as an environmental improvement activity. Funds for the council could come from a carbon pollution tax. And Annette Smith, Executive Director of Vermonters for a Clean Environment, questions the time frame here. She says, what other things are we planning out to 2050? A while back, natural gas was in short supply. Then along came fracking, game changer in 5 years. 5 years ago, nobody heard of a heat pump. Now they're all the rage. What will be new in 5 years? I'm sorry, but it seems absurd to be attempting to use today's technologies to plan out to 2050. The Shumlin administration has taken energy planning to an unnecessary extreme. Hopefully, a new administration will be reality-based rather than forcing its major donors' ideology on the populace. What do you think about that, Asa Hopkins?
So, first, statute requires us to look out 20 years. So that takes the 2035. We have statutory and other greenhouse gas targets that go out to 2050. So I think we really do need to take a long-term perspective. Given that a lot of what we're talking about is infrastructure, we're talking about long-term assets. We're talking about buildings, a building that will get built today and still be around in 100 years. We're talking about cars that will still be on the road in 10 or 15 years, road infrastructure that may still be here in multiple generations. Thinking about making changes in that system, you've got to be able to think long term about how infrastructure needs to be able to evolve to hit goals, not just goals in the next 10 years, but beyond.
Let's hear from William Driscoll now for a business perspective. He's Vice President of Associated Industries of Vermont. And as I mentioned, we're going to get a couple of the constituencies in here, and Bill represents a big chunk of them. So, Bill Driscoll, nice to have you on the program.
Well, thanks for having me.
So, for the Associated Industries of Vermont, what's your take on this draft plan and what you like and don't like about it?
Well, I mean, I think as you sort of hinted at the outset, I mean, this is a very, very large, wide-ranging document. It's tied in with a lot of other statutes and regulations. So it's the issues with the draft are not necessarily simple or black and white. But I would say in general, in terms of the overall emphasis on priorities among the various goals, we would think that there should be a greater emphasis on the economic impact of energy policy. The potential for good or bad impacts on the economy are much greater with energy policy than they are, say, for the environment, where particularly on the electricity side, we already have a very clean portfolio. So there's not a lot that can be accomplished for good or bad on that side compared to the job impact side. So with that, we'd like to see a greater emphasis on the economic impact, a greater embracing of the problems that we have in Vermont in terms of our very high electric rates. We have, you know, 40 to 50% higher rates recently for commercial and industrial customers, and that's an area that I think needs greater emphasis, particularly on the rate design side. And the report does look at smart rates, for example, but there's a lot more that could be done for rate design to try to look at how we can retain and recruit the kind of jobs that we need for the state's economy and for just the welfare of Vermonters in general.
So, Bill, you'd like to see more ideas about how to generate jobs within a plan like this, or would you even say, let's scrap the 90% if it looks like the economic forecast does not bode well for Vermont?
Right. Well, with regard to the renewable energy aspect, I mean, beyond simply looking at rate issues, I think there does need to be greater flexibility and cost consciousness, I think, on the renewable side. And certainly there is some, but I think a strict adherence to a given percentage year by year and trying to focus on looking at particular scale of renewable energy or looking at in-state as a priority rather than simply looking at what is the most affordable and sustainable and reasonable source for energy, be it renewable or otherwise. It's better to look at what makes the most cost sense and not have a policy that gets too tied up in, you know, it has to be in-state to a certain degree, or it has to be small scale to a certain degree, because when you do that, you really lose sight, I think, of some of the cost and even some of the reliability priorities that we should have.
Are you in favor of the goal in general, this idea of 90% renewable energy by 2050? Is that something that you support?
We certainly support cost-effective and reasonable renewable energy in the portfolio. We're not wedded to a particular percentage, and I don't think that it's necessarily the best policy approach to be overly strict in that regard, because you do end up in a situation where if you're overly committed to those sort of fixed targets, you can end up paying more than you really should and maybe getting less reliable energy than we need, and without necessarily getting a meaningful benefit, be it economic or environmental, in exchange for that. So we support a much more flexible approach in that regard.
William Driscoll is Vice President of Associated Industries of Vermont. Thanks very much for your perspective today.
No problem. Anytime.
We're talking about Vermont's Comprehensive Energy Plan, which is up for renewal now. It's in the draft stage, and there are public input sessions held around the state. That a couple have been held already, three more still to go. We'd love to know what you're thinking. Have you attended one of the public hearings? We've got Asa Hopkins, the state's Director of Energy Policy and Planning, in the studio with us. And if you have something that you'd like to say to him, if you want to weigh in on this draft plan, you can call 1-800-639-2211. A lot of people on the phone, though, so if you can't get through, go ahead onto the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. You can have a conversation there. It goes on whether the show's happening or not, and there's a really interesting discussion that's ongoing, people interacting with one another. It's at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Let's go to Ben, who's calling in from Montpelier. Hi, Ben. Go ahead. Your thoughts.
Hi. I'd like to thank the Public Service Department for their continued commitment to these energy and greenhouse gas emissions goals. Our Vermont's efforts in efficiency and renewables have led to lower and generally more stable rates than a lot of our New England counterparts over the years, and continuing to move towards energy independence will pay huge dividends to our economic future as we face more uncertain regional and global energy markets. This transition will also continue to provide important jobs to all Vermonters. And as a recent college graduate, I'm here because Vermont is leading the nation towards the energy solutions that we know must be implemented, and I want to be a part of it.
Ben, thanks for your comment. Appreciate that. Michael's calling in from Burlington. Go right ahead, Michael. You're on.
Yeah. Thank you very much for having me. Just going forward, I think that we need to be actually more aggressive in our energy policy because climate change is our biggest issue that we have. And as Ben actually just said, in the past few years, we've actually reduced our energy incentives, and we've grown over 1,000 jobs.
Michael, your line is really bad, but I hear what you're saying, that Vermont really needs to be a leader in renewable energy, and you're talking about how Vermont is already working hard on that, and I think I heard you say we need more aggressive targets than we currently have. I'm sorry to cut you off there. I appreciate your perspective. And Alec is calling in from Burlington. One more in here now. Hi, Alec. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I just want to say that I agree with stuff that Michael and Ben have said. I think one important thing to look at is we have these federal tax credits for stuff like solar panels that are winding down in the coming years. And really, to make up for that, we need a market-based solution like a carbon pollution tax that really allows individuals to make these kind of upgrades on their own as well.
Alec, thanks for the call. So the carbon pollution tax, Asa Hopkins, is that something that you're thinking about?
Yeah, it's something that we analyzed as part of the total energy study that we did in the gap between the last plan and this one. We looked at what it would take, how that would work. We identified a number of issues. We weren't trying to write legislation, but we identified a particular a range of issues of if you were going to go about and try to implement a carbon tax or a cap and trade or some other sort of big market based policy option. What are the kind of things you would need to take into account? And that informs, how that's discussed. Those sort of principles for implementation are present in the draft plan.
We got a note from David in Ferrisburg who says, with all of the new solar incentives and financing schemes, there's been a huge increase in solar installations, particularly noticeable in Addison County. Though the ban placed on billboards in 1968 or through that ban, the state makes it clear that they understand and appreciate the value of our scenic vistas, a boon to the tourist economy and a key component to the quality of life here in Vermont. If we're not careful, it seems we risk saving ourselves from one visual blight only to grant free rein to another. David wants to know what checks and balances are being put in to ensure we don't end up with solar panels around every curve and cluttering up every field. And Mark says Vermont's energy plan requires small distributed power plants throughout the state's communities. This in turn will require the support of the state's communities. What is state government's plan for winning back the confidence and support of Vermont's towns? Or does the state think that it can achieve the energy goals described in the Comprehensive Energy Plan by continuing to shove energy projects down the throats of our communities? Well, that's what we're going to talk about next when we come back. We're going to be talking with Karen Horn from the Vermont League of Cities and Towns about what communities want to be able to have in terms of input in siting projects and in the Comprehensive Energy Plan in general. And if you want to weigh in with your thoughts, 1-800-639-2211, or post them on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Asa Hopkins is Vermont's Director of Energy Policy and Planning. He's helping explain what goes into the state's comprehensive energy plan and how the public can have input. And we're getting some of that input right now from all of you. Our number, if you'd like to weigh in on how you see the plan shaping up and what you want it to be, is 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or at vpr.net. We've talked about how individuals have input into the process, and we're hearing from a lot of you. We got Rick, who says, I'd like to see a Green Technology Development Council set up. I think we read Rick's comments. We've got a lot of people weighing in here saying, look, I just have thoughts that I want in this plan. I want them weighed in. Spence in Weybridge, while many people argue for greater local control over alternative energy infrastructure location, it's important to keep in mind that statewide and even regional planning is essential in moving us away from reliance reliance on fossil fuels. Our railroad network was critical to Vermont's economic development in the 19th century, and it's still vitally important today. It never would have been built if individual towns had the right to veto railway routes. In finding a balance between considering the siting concerns of towns and citizens, we need to make sure that the energy needs of our entire state are being met. While we're waiting here for Karen Horn from the Vermont League of Cities and Towns, let's go to Andy, who's calling in from Middlesex. Hi, Andy. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call. It seems to me that there is a tremendous amount of not-in-my-backyard sentiment in Vermont, given its demographic, regarding wind turbines on every ridgeline and solar panels in every formerly agricultural field. And some of the people that I've been talking to are actually now reconsidering their original objections to nuclear power. And I wonder if a centrally well-located nuclear power plant, brand new, state-of-the-art, could meet the objections of all of those people who don't want to see a vast proliferation of wind turbines and solar panels. Nuclear power has a good safety record, probably the best of any, and its carbon footprint is minimal, and we don't have to make other states pay in order to produce more carbon in the atmosphere.
Andy, thanks for your call. Asa Hopkins, what about that idea? I mean, we just got rid of our nuclear power plant, but what about that as an option?
So, part of our job is to look at all the different options. If you look around the U.S. at where nuclear plants are being developed today, they're struggling economically. The current plants are struggling economically, and new plants are struggling hitting their cost targets. They tend to be much more expensive than they were expected to be. If an existing power plant fully depreciated, like Vermont Yankee or the Pilgrim plant in Massachusetts that just announced that it was going to retire, if such a plant can't manage to keep itself running economically in the New England markets, it's hard to think how a new plant that had to pay off all of its capital would be able to actually functionally operate while meeting Bill Driscoll's concerns about cost.
All right, so I've teased some of the comments here about towns and cities and communities and how they're going to be able to have a voice in this, because, we've heard from people that this is a problem for them. In July, we talked with Peter Rothschild, a member of the Planning Commission in New Haven, about the solar arrays cropping up in his town. We heard from David in Ferrisburg talking about how in Addison County, especially, you're seeing a lot of small-scale solar arrays cropping up in fields. And Peter Rothschild said that he was really frustrated about communities being left out of the process. Here's what he said.
The local towns really are out of the process. Politicians that will tell us to come to our town meeting and participate, the town participates, passes zoning laws, town plans, and then the state government blows them away. This isn't great policy. I would like to see something where the towns are really incented to work with the state and with developers to solve this problem.
Karen Horn is Director of Public Policy and Advocacy at the Vermont League of Cities and Towns, and she's with us on the line now. Hi, Karen. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Is that a fairly common frustration that towns and cities are facing when it comes to where these projects are being sited?
Yeah, that is really the biggest issue that we hear about as a municipal association, is what's the place for a municipal voice on the siting issues.
And what's the problem? What would you like, or what would cities and towns like to be able to do that they can't do now?
Yeah, so if I may, as you mentioned, the plan that's being proposed now is 380 pages, but if you want to look at the land use and siting sections of it, you can just look at pages 50 to 54. That's where they talk about that. And I have to say that local governments support the move to renewable energy. We support the goal of 90% by 2050 if it's achieved in balance with our other land use goals and priorities. And if it's also achieved through aggressive efficiency measures, which the Comprehensive Energy Plan talks about also. But we would like to see a process where the Public Service Board gives what's called substantial deference, really a very heavy weight, to municipal concerns and determinations. They hold hearings in municipalities that are potentially affected by the project. They include the local decisions concerning the project in their Public Service Board docket, and they formulate areas of inquiry based on those concerns, and they address those concerns in their local decisions. I do want to point out also that we have never asked for a veto of projects, and we're not doing that now. What we really need to see is a process that respects local government issues around siting.
So we got a note from Steve who says, if Vermont is ever going to reach its renewable energy goals, it'll have to devise a mechanism for overriding the scourge of local NIMBYism that's so rampant in the state. Everyone says they're in favor of renewable energy in principle, but only as long as they don't have to see it. Propose wind turbines or solar farms, and people complain about the effect on their pristine views. They insist that all their power come from somewhere else, in somebody else's views. We need to be able to put the general statewide good above local NIMBYists in order to build up our renewable energy infrastructure and take responsibility for our own power consumption. Karen, I know that word NIMBY, I mean, boy, is that a loaded term. But what about and how would you address the idea that communities might say, I'm totally in favor of these goals, but I don't really think that we have a place for solar development, say, in our community. I mean, how do you balance that?
Well, I think if you look at the Public Service Board permitting process right now, you have a system where those concerns are not addressed at all. And we haven't even actually given the opportunity to provide some balance around what are the legitimate issues that that regard siting of a particular facility in a municipality versus the larger statewide goal of achieving 90% by 2050. And where the Public Service Board could draw their own conclusions about whether those considerations are legitimate or not and whether they should be addressed in a decision. But right now, that just doesn't happen. It's very one-sided right now in terms of just going ahead and citing the facilities. And I should also say that that is because the overriding purpose, mission of the Public Service Board is to assure our secure energy future. We think there needs to be some balance there.
Well, Karen, let's give that to Asa Hopkins. Karen Horn is Director of Public Policy and Advocacy at the Vermont League of Cities and Towns. Karen, thanks.
Thank you.
So, Asa Hopkins, what about how towns can, I mean, because we've heard, as I mentioned from Peter Rothschild, this idea that individual landowners can put up these developments that sort of bypass town zoning, and the towns feel like, whoa, we just don't even have a voice in this. So how are you addressing that?
So, you know, at this point, the plan basically defers to the Solar Siting Task Force, and I think Karen may actually be a member of that task force, and they'll come out with their recommendations. All the plan says now is to work on those recommendations. So we're very much in the listening phase now. One thing we are doing is we, the department, have funded three of the regional planning commissions to do comprehensive energy planning at the regional level, including a land use component, looking at all different kinds of renewable sources, as well as, of course, the RPCs are very good at transportation-related land use planning. It's one of their main purposes, one of their main thrusts and expertise. And so the work that they can do in a comprehensive manner at the regional level to look at land use issues, both siting-wise and as relates to transportation energy, is really something that we're bullish on that being a way to bridge between the local level and the state level.
So that is something that you think needs to be worked on, that relationship between communities and the state in how we reach these goals?
It's an ongoing conversation. We're in a bit of a growing pains stage now. And I think in 5 or 10 years, we'll have a much better sense of what the processes are going to be that are going to enable this large-scale infrastructure transition, I don't think we necessarily have all the answers today.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there for now. We'll have to talk about this idea of how in the world are we going to address this issue of our transportation infrastructure and the energy picture there for another discussion, but that's good. There's plenty to talk about. Dr. Asa Hopkins is Vermont's Director of Energy Policy and Planning. Thanks for talking with us today.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
There are three more public hearings coming up this month in Montpelier, Westminster, and Rutland. We have a link to full details at vpr.net. Click on today's Vermont edition. Coming up, the opium addiction epidemic of the 19th century. We'll hear from historian Gary Shattuck, who has researched why Vermont was awash in opium products in the late 1800s. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In his 2014 State of the State Address, Governor Peter Shumlin called our attention to the heroin and opiate addiction crisis going on across Vermont. But this is not the first time the state has faced an opiate epidemic. In 1900, a doctor named A.P. Grinnell estimated that Vermont druggists, doctors, and general stores were dispensing a staggering 3.3 million doses of opium every month. That's 1.5 doses per day for every adult man and woman living in the state at the time. Author and historian Gary Shattuck writes about Grinnell's findings and the popularity of opium in the most recent issue of Vermont History, the Journal of the Vermont Historical Society.
Ashbel Grinnell is a fascinating man. He took on this project at the request of the Vermont Medical Society in 1899, and he was tasked with going ahead and making a survey of the state's manufacturers, wholesalers, physicians, pharmacists, druggist, anyone that had anything to do with drugs. And he came out with an amazing summary that a number of pounds of morphine, of opium, cocaine, other drugs of that like were being consumed in the state. Unfortunately, we don't have the math that he used, but I don't have any reason to not agree with what he's saying, where he comes up with 3.3 million doses every month were being sold by druggists alone here in Vermont. And he only restricted his survey or his analysis to druggists alone because a number of other entities, doctors, manufacturers, were not cooperative and would not disclose the amounts that they were involved with.
And in fact, many druggists didn't disclose, right? I mean, there's some question about he thought he might be able to multiply his finding by a factor of five to get a more accurate assessment.
Right. He was very confident in his analysis, and he said that this is very conservative, and to reach a more realistic number, you could multiply his findings by five times.
So what did that mean? 3 million doses was how much for the population of Vermont at the time?
Keep in mind, he was with the UVM Medical School. He was a dean there, a highly respected doctor in the Burlington community. In his math, he works it out to roughly 1.5 doses per day per adult here in the state. So 1 month of distribution or sales is 1.5 doses for each adult every day of the year.
It's kind of staggering to think about that. Why were people using opium products? What were they using them for?
Well, there was an awful lot of overprescribing being done by the medical community. There was a free access to drugs. They were not restricted in any way, either through the doctors or from the local pharmacies or drug stores. And they came in a number of different varieties, both in the form of opium or in morphine, injectable morphine by hypodermic, or concealed in what they called patent medicines, or nostrums, or quack medicines that were freely available, widely available by, to the community.
And these would be things that were called like Dr. Jane's fabulous pill, and it would contain some opium?
Absolutely. It was highly misleading. And it's what led in 1906 to the federal government passing the Pure Food and Drug Act, which required these concoctions to disclose their contents.
So were people using opium to try to treat medical conditions, whether a doctor was advising them to or they were self-medicating? Or was this sort of a social drug in the way that we've seen some other pretty dangerous drugs have been social drugs in the past?
Right. It's all of the above. Starting in roughly 1866 and lasting for the next 40 years, we see reports by members of the Vermont Medical Society and the Vermont Pharmaceutical Association reporting the excessive amount of opium and morphine that's being consumed by the population. And in fact, one of the doctors talks about the fact that there is more opium being consumed than could be attributed for medicinal uses. So we know that people were using it, we would call it recreationally today.
Mm-hmm.
Continually, the medical community was putting the state on alert that we had a drug problem growing.
And they knew it was addictive?
This is something that was progressively learned as the century went on. Certainly by the 1890s, nationally, there was a big drug epidemic going on. But according to the numbers, Vermont was off the charts compared to the rest of the country.
Do you have a sense, Gary, of why that might be? This was a national problem, but particularly it sounds like a rural problem, and it was a real big problem in Vermont.
Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of descriptions by opium users at the time, but if you read the temperance literature and you read carefully what it is the doctors are saying, they're reporting uses by the community at large, and it's being done quietly, silently within the families, and it's not getting out into the community unless it becomes so open and blatant as to pose a problem. And then by early 1890s, we start to see addiction itself being addressed, and we see the Keeley Institute opening up in Montpelier to deal with not only alcoholics and tobacco chewers, but the opium chewers.
You also write disturbingly that many parents were giving opium to their children to try to control behavior or to get them to calm down or go to sleep. And they were often mixing it with sugar, which then, you know, not only made it palatable for the kids, but triggered some pleasure sensors that this is something they really wanted to have.
Correct. This was interesting. It comes to light in a noted doctor in the Middlebury area talking about what it takes to get children to take medicine. And he talks about the fact that in order to get them to take alcohol, because that was believed to be in some way medicinally a positive thing, that you would mix sugar with the alcohol, and then you would mix sugar with the opium to get them to take that. So the children go on to build this addiction. We see Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup being sold openly. And that's got a lot of opium in it, and it's used to quiet the children when need be and when they're going through the teething process. The problem was that they ended up giving so much drugs sometimes, they had to counteract those drugs with other drugs, resulting in more problems. So keep in mind, this is a large self-medicating population.
Gary, if doctors who were researching this and writing papers knew that opium addiction was a problem and that the sort of free distribution of this class of drugs was a problem in Vermont, why didn't it abate sooner?
Vermont was very proud of the fact that in 1852 they instituted a prohibition against the manufacture and sale of alcohol. This became the focus of legislative efforts throughout the last half of the 19th century. To give you an idea of just how much was going on in 1894, if you looked at the laws, you would see 23 pages of laws devoted to prohibition enforcement with 111 sections. If you looked at the drug laws at the same time, there was less than a page with three sections dealing with drugs. So the state was focused on prohibition to the point where legislators were not listening to the medical community who was alerting them to this existing problem. And so it continued to spiral out of control until Grinnell released his study, and then both nationally and on the state level, changes started to come about after that point.
But you also write that there were many doctors and pharmacists who knew that this was how they were going to make their money, and they weren't interested, even if they knew that this was an addictive substance that was dangerous, they weren't interested in trying to tell people not to take it.
Certainly, there was a good portion of each of the communities, medically and pharmaceutically, that were involved in that. If you looked at the chain, coming from the drug manufacturers, Wells Richardson and Burlington being one of them, to the pharmacists, and then the sales of the drugs to the doctors, there are reports of kickbacks going up the chain to each one of the suppliers. And then we also have a report of doctors writing in code so that a favored pharmacist would be the only one to interpret a particular prescription.
So was it action by the state government in the end that helped curb the addiction problem, the epidemic of opiate addiction in Vermont after 1900?
Well, it's difficult to say whether or not it curbed the addiction itself, but it certainly put the laws center stage. And it was as the basis of these other reports that the doctors were making, and then Grinnell's expulsive report, which in part, I suspect, helped to lead to the, in 1914, to the Harrison Narcotics Tax Act, which was introduced, interestingly enough, by Vermont Congressman David Foster in 1910. And I think it was probably had to do a lot with Grinnell's report that was pushing that along. When testimony was introduced in Congress that even in Vermont, of all places, we see this, it certainly got a lot of people's attention.
Gary Shattuck is an author and historian who lives in Shrewsbury. He'll be giving the inaugural Sam B. Hand Memorial Lecture on this topic Tuesday evening at UVM. Gary, thanks very much for telling us about this point in Vermont history.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right, and it's time to grab your binoculars or maybe just look out into your own backyard to search for birds during the fall migration. And tomorrow on this show, we'll have bird diva Bridget Butler here to help you identify what you're seeing, and she can guide you on what to look for right now. Send your questions or let us know what you've spotted by emailing vermontedition@vpr.net, and then listen tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Singeri and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Hannah Kearns. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. Mary William directed the show, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.